pocket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between. An insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way.
Morning. Welcome to the Jeff Poor Show on FN Talk 106.5. Good Friday morning to you. Thank you for joining us. We do appreciate it. It's Friday. It's finally Friday. Text line 251-343-0106. You need to be in touch and be your show host. All you got to do is hit me up on that text line, and I will respond to whatever it is that is on your mind. Coming up on the program, Todd Stacey from Alabama Daily News. That'll kick us off here in about a half hour. Bradley Jay, my colleague at Breitbart News, will be making time for us at the 10 o'clock hour. And at 11 o'clock hour, we'll talk to the returning champion of the Jeff Poor Show, State Senator Chris Elliott, as we do usually at that time on a Friday. So make sure you stay tuned for that. Once again, the text line 251-343. 0106. We're still in the throes of kind of like the opening stages, I suppose, of the election cycle. As early as it is, kind of a ridiculous like 18 months. A lot of that is because we have our primaries earlier, a little earlier than we used to, and you have to start a year out from the primary, and then you get a month for the runoff, and then the general election in most places in Alabama is a mere formality. There are very few swing districts. If it's Democrat, it's Democrat. If it's Republican, it's Republican. It's very gerrymandered as far as the legislature goes. And that's not just Republicans who do that. This is what Democrats who sign off on this. They have very solid blue districts, and they know their people. But as the announcements come rolling in, we will evaluate each one. And obviously, we'll get some of these guys on. We got Rick Pate coming up on Monday, candidate for lieutenant governor. Keep hearing John Wall's name. Chairman of the Alabama Republican Party. There'll be some others, I am sure. Probably the big one we need to watch is a United States Senate. Somebody who will not rule themselves out, but I don't know, is a legitimate contender. Mo Brooks, formerly of the 5th Congressional District. He couldn't do it. He couldn't get it done with Trump's endorsement. I don't know that he could get it done with... being at odds with Donald Trump, at least in Alabama. But probably going to be some names we haven't heard. Now, I also hear Attorney General, Lieutenant Governor, U.S. Senate even for Caroline Dobson, even though she is going to be appointed to the PSC. That's got to really settle itself out. That's a big office. Once she gets, and we were expecting that announcement this week, but I hear that Twinkle Kavanaugh's actual resignation to go work in the Trump administration isn't effective until today, so Ivy will not be able to announce her replacement till next week, and that's why it's taking a little longer. But she still could run for something, even in that from that standpoint, from that position. Which is still, I guess, people are kind of waiting to see who's going to announce that we didn't already know. We knew Tommy Tuberville for governor, and we kind of knew Steve Marshall for Senate. So it's a wait and see. It's something we need to talk about. And so Donald Trump in a Truth Social post last night went after the Federalist Society, which I think generally does good work. But he's really bothered by some of these judges that he helped appoint, well, he did appoint, based on their recommendations, and really went after the former chairman, Leonard Leo. Called him a sleazebag and said he probably hated America. He wrote, quote, I am so disappointed in the Federal Society because of the bad advice they gave me on numerous judicial nominations. This is something that cannot be forgotten. And I think the biggest disappointment, at least from my standpoint, is Amy Coney Barrett. She was the it girl. Now, she's an upgrade from Ginsburg. The Clinton-appointed former ACLU lawyer. I think we've been let down. We have these elite institutions inside the conservative movement. And it really is, there really are the elites. You got to have the right pedigree. You have to be Ivy League educated. You have to be a member of a certain religion or denomination. There's a lot of that. We don't have... The closest thing we got to like Antonin Scalia is maybe Justice Alito. Justice Thomas. But Trump's going to have to fill those voids. He's had to do it sooner rather than later. There's a good chance Republicans lose the Senate in 2026. And if you don't, you make some appointments and you have a Democrat Senate, I mean, what are you going to get? So this is an important discussion to have right now. I don't think we need Judge Jeanine as a Supreme Court justice. I think this is a discussion that probably needs to start pretty soon. Who would fill those? Voids. Younger judges. They'll be on the court a long time and preserve this majority Republicans have on the high court. It's very important. Now, let's talk about that. I think the thing to watch, why is Trump doing this? He's obviously irritated by some of the rulings from some of the judges he had appointed. One of the judges on the Court of International Trade that struck down his tariffs was one of his appointees. Now it was a unanimous decision. It wouldn't have made a difference. But that's what triggered this response. And everybody's like, oh, how could he do that? Why would he do that? Federal Society, FedSoc is a pretty good organization. But what I suspect, and you know, we always give Donald Trump credit for playing 3D chess, but probably when we shouldn't. But he doesn't want to be beholden to the Federal Society anymore on judicial nominations. And I think part of the reason he was, it was a Mitch McConnell thing. Mitch McConnell was, you know, when he was leader in the Senate, he had a list. These are the people I want to be a Supreme Court justice. And I'm not like one of these guys who thinks we need some kind of the diversity quota on the court or whatever. But you do have a ruling class of elitist, and you should have the most qualified jurist. For sure. No doubt about it. But our elite institutions, at least in the last decade, have really let us down, and that's the Harvard, Yale, Cornell, Brown, Princeton, Columbia types. Those are the ones who have not really gotten the job done. I mean, you know, you look at some of the, like, well, what were they thinking? Bush appointee or not? I don't think you need to have the federal judge who went to, like, law school night classes from somewhere. But maybe we don't need Ivy League judges on the Supreme Court. So my hope is that if, and this is me maybe reading into it, we don't need like the treasurer of the Federalist Society as a Supreme Court judge, just given the politics of that. You would like to see someone from Kansas or, you know, the map spread out a little bit rather than the Northeast Alita corridor that is ruling in a way that impacts the entire country. The more DC circuit types. 251-343-0106. I think it's a big deal what he posted on True Social. Now, maybe it was just him venting, and he's just like, you know, enough of this. But the courts have been a problem here, and it's not just Obama or Biden or Clinton judges. It's been Bush and Trump judges. Whether or not you agree with them or not. And that's what the Republican Party or a Republican president and a Republican U.S. Senate that has to handle the confirmations needs to take into account. Like, okay, we're at this state, we're at this position where Trump's trying to do a bunch of things. They allowed Biden to get away with the same legal theories and practices, but all of a sudden, because it's Trump, we're going to halt a lot of this. Well, how did these judges get there? What's going on in the federal courts? Democrats, the high court was always fearful of Democrats because they always talked about packing the court. Republicans don't do that, so there's less of an incentive to rule in favor of a Republican president. I think that's honestly how Obamacare survived, because John Roberts was an institutionalist and he feared really that Democrats would keep one of their pledges. They would try to make D.C. and Puerto Rico a state, pack the Supreme Court, and we'd have 100 years of, like, Democrat, left-wing, Western European socialism in America. They don't have that threat as much from Republicans, and they do a little bit more, a little more disappointing for Republican causes. Let's get a break in here. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5.
Counting flowers on the wall that don't bother me at all. Playing solitaire till dawn with the deck of 51. Smoking cigarettes and watching Captain Kangaroo. Now don't tell me I've nothing to do.
It's good to see. Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thank you for staying with us on this Friday morning, 251-343-0106. If you want to be in touch with me, your show host, hit us up there. Mommy Issues writes, Jeff, I find it strange the last 4 decades since Reagan we've had free market conservatives that took a hands-off approach to business and championed free trade agreements around the world, to now having Trump walk onto the stage with conservatives now screaming terrorist and protectionism. I want to push back on that a little bit. I think it was Democrats who was Clinton with the trade agreements in the 90s, Mommy Issues. Now, you look, he brought Republicans along with him to the dance, and they backed it on the auspices of free trade. But, I go to a lot of Republican events and speeches and think tank sort of things, and like there's no like banner hanging up in the room saying support free trade. The deal of free trade, Mommy Issues, is yeah, fine. Free trade is great. But you're never going to get a system of free trade on the globe because the other participants aren't going to adhere to the same free trade practices. And in 2025, the economy is global now. You know, free trade made sense in the 80s or even before that. We don't have that anymore. Like, United States can lower tariffs and have policy that protects or that's anti-protectionism, but it don't matter. It doesn't matter if the Japanese, Chinese, Germans, British, or whoever are putting tariffs on our products when we try to export them. That's the difference, that the economy has changed. I mean, you really started hearing first about this, Mommy Issues, in the 90s with Pat Buchanan. So I kind of reject the last 4 decades that it post Reagan. I don't think conservatives have been unified on trade. Also, I think a lot of the free trade talk, Mommy Issues, is it's corporatism. It's a talking point used for Wall Street to be able to use cheaper labor around the world and not have to, face the scrutiny of not hiring American or building American, manufacturing American. Well, we all support free trade. We're good Republicans, but it's been abused. That's why Trump is a thing. Trump's not a traditional Reagan Republican. Culturally, yes. I think the magic of Trump, if you want to call it that, or the phenomenon or whatever, is that he's like very pro-American and he's not afraid to like wave the flag and embrace like sort of this idea of American exceptionalism, or if you want to call it this, sort of gaudiness of America, gold, big flags, pomp and circumstance, fireworks. Don't shy away from Americana. The left has done that. It's more nationalism than conservatism. So I the tariffs and protectionism, like I said, it really started with Pat Buchanan, who was not a Democrat. Jeff Sessions, to some degree. This has been underway, a phenomenon in Republican Party politics for a little while. Now, look, they used to kind of dismiss Buchananism. And I know he's like got some really weird views on Israel and World War II, but this one of the central themes, it really is preserving the culture and doing what's best for America, doing what's best for the United States, and not really embracing this ideological thing that's not going to work unless everyone's on board. The left does it all the time. I can talk about that more. Sorry to get the more of your text. Let's get our break in here. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Poore Show on FM Talk 106.5.
They set me up in the chair.
Welcome back to the Jeff Poore Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thank you for staying with us on this Friday morning. Text line, you want to be in touch with me, your show host, 251-343-0106. Still to come, Bradley J., my colleague at Breitbart News. That's about an hour from now, and then it's Friday, so we'll hear from State Senator Chris Elliott at the bottom of the 11 o'clock hour. Stick around for that. Joining us now is the publisher of Alabama Daily News and the host of Capital Journal at Alabama Public Television. Todd Stacey is with us. Todd, good morning. How are you?
I'm great, Jeff. How are you?
I am well. Todd Pettiford coming back.
Yeah, I was tempted to once again change my name in the email newsletter to Todd Stacey, but I'm pretty excited about that.
Yeah, so I mean, it looks like a decent lineup per Earl Hess for this coming season, but I don't know. It's all new names except for Pettiford, and you never know how that's going to gel.
I guess it just depends whether or not Bruce Pearl runs for Senate.
And I don't think that's going to happen either. I maybe someday I can see it, but there's no way he's going to walk away at this point in time.
Oh, no. It's just, you know, it's funny people talking about it. It's just part of the political season.
Yeah, and you put something like that out there, and like a D.C. publication, you really got to wonder, like, where does this come from? Is just somebody needing clickbait, or is there someone trying to, I mean, it's like all the possibilities, someone trying to stir up something on the recruiting trail, are there people really, like, a real, true, honest draft Bruce Pearl movement somewhere out there?
Yeah. To me, it seemed kind of like an NRSC thing, like a not like coordinated, but somebody just being, you know, a little too much time on their hands. But I agree with you. It's not going to happen. But it is shaping up.
Well, I talked to these guys kind of in that orbit in D.C. And you know, how many times has D.C. been burned by Alabama in the U.S. Senate race and sort of D.C. conventional wisdom not really working out the way it was supposed to? And it's always amusing to me. And I feel like, you know, Steve Marshall's a proven commodity. I think a lot of people know who he is and is the front runner for right now. But I mean, I can't help but worry that you're going to have some kind of like DC sort of operation trying to engineer a campaign of, you know, somebody else.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I've seen that happen so many times over the years, and it's not just Senate, it's Congress too, that some of these national firms come in, these consultants that have no experience in Alabama, no clue how Alabama works, and you can just predict it. It's so predictable that goes wrong. So I think from what I can tell so far early in the campaign, Steve Marshall had mostly Alabama folks, right? Alabama focused folks. You need folks that understand Senate races. And you know, those people work around the country, but yeah, you can't just, you know, you can't be cookie cutter. What works in Ohio doesn't necessarily work in Alabama. And so, you gotta remember all that. So I think he is, but you're right. We've had an interesting history. If you think back to, the Doug Jones, Roy Moore situation. If you can go back to 2020 with Tuberville, I mean, I've been kind of reliving that, going back and reading some of those articles, because as much of a sure thing as Tuberville is now, it's so popular and everything now, go back in 2020, that was not a sure thing, right? That was a pretty tight race, especially early on before the Alpha endorsement. So, our history with the U.S. Senate is pretty interesting, which makes me excited about this race. Obviously, Steve Marshall getting in you're right. He's the front runner at the outset. I expect at least four or five other candidates. I don't know how many serious candidates, but I do expect people to get in. It's just too tempting. A U.S. Senate seat is so coveted. And, I mean, Marshall isn't Tuberville, right? He doesn't have universal name ID. He's going to have to work for it. He doesn't completely clear the field. However, I do sense from talking to him some fire in the belly. I really think he is after this. He wants it. He has this sense of purpose about it. And that makes him really formidable, not just the name and not just name ID and issues and all that. But if you really want something, you're going to work for it and be as smart as he is and work. That makes him a formidable candidate.
Well, Alabama's not used to this musical chair situation of the U.S. Senate we have, at least not in the last 50 years. Now, in the late 70s, when James Allen died, I think that there was, you know, going all the way with Stewart and Denton, and then finally Shelby settling in there. But you look at the last batch of senators pre-Luther Strange, I guess. I mean, with Shelby, Sessions was in there for a few terms. Hal Heflin, even go before that with Sparkman and Lister Hill. I mean, you go all the way back to the early 1900s. And, you know, people in Alabama just, they aren't used to these kinds of, you know, usually you get elected to Senate in Alabama, you're there as long as you want to be. And here, in the last 10 years, look how many different Senate races we've had.
Yeah, you're right. You didn't leave the Senate unless there were pretty special circumstances. I mean, Jeff Sessions had a good reason. He went to be attorney general. I mean, I wonder what you'd say now about that, hindsight being what it is. I was having a conversation yesterday. It's like, you know, if none of that would have happened, if Jeff Sessions doesn't go to become attorney general under Trump, he's probably like a Senate committee chairman right now. He's probably like chairman of armed services or something. You know, that's crazy to think about. So you're right. Like, normally nobody gives up that seniority willingly. That's a good reason, attorney general, but to run for governor, that's why this is so surprising to everybody. We're all trying to wrap our heads around it. That why would you give up this seat? But I don't, you know, Tuberville doesn't think like, you know, typical politicos and politicians. He thinks differently. And I know you had a conversation with him. He's going to be on Capitol Journal tonight. And that's one of the things I was asking him was, you know, why would you give that? And he reminded me that he said, look, when I first started thinking about politics, governor was my first ambition. You know, I really wanted to run for governor first, but, you know, the Bentley thing happened and KIV, and there was no path there, and he didn't really think, you know, that was fine. So that's what, so if you think about it that way, it starts making sense. Like, he actually, this was the job he actually wanted, not U.S. Senate. Plus, I mean, I think after 4 years in the Senate, you know, you can tell whether or not it's your cup of tea. You can tell whether or not you actually like the job. Clearly, he doesn't love it. Otherwise, he wouldn't be leaving it. But you're right. It's a really interesting political dynamic.
Well, and, you know, Tuberville right now, I mean, I'm not quite, you know, I'm pretty close to call him governor-elect, but I'm not there yet. Let's look down the field a little. And I like try to contemplate, like, what does it look like? What you know, the machinery is going to, it seems like, at least as far as the governor is concerned, is moving at a slow pace. Tuberville comes in, he's ambitious, he's got an agenda, and the machinery in Montgomery at that point in time in 2027 will have been, you know, do you get the sense they're bracing for changes there? And I can't imagine, like, just sort of the way it's been, it will have been for about a decade. And then all of a sudden, I mean, you really are going to see a different sort of dynamic in Montgomery.
You're right. And yeah, I think everybody's bracing, but there's a long runway here. And this is part of our conversation with Coach as well, is, you know, let's just assume that he will be governor. There's an 18-month runway here where he has the opportunity to really learn about how state government works, figure out what he likes, what he doesn't like. And so you're seeing a lot of rhetoric now, and that's what it is. It's rhetoric because he doesn't, you know, it's not a criticism, but he's never worked in state government or been around it or anything. And so there's a lot of rhetoric about, yep, we're going to shake things up. We're going to make cuts. We're going to do this. Well, he's got a long time between now and January 2027 to figure out what of that needs to become reality and not. So I think what you're going to see from now until then is, like you said, studying up on it, you know, introducing himself to various groups that have, you know, influence in Montgomery. Because I think the perception a lot of times is from anybody that just kind of looks from the outside at not just Washington, but Montgomery specifically, is like, oh, they're all just, you know, this kind of swampy thing. It's like, no, it's fake government. It's pretty boring. And there absolutely could be more efficiencies, and every administration comes in wanting to do that, and that's good. I think that's a good, refreshing thing. But it's not as if it's some kind of Washington, D.C. bloated, you know, swamp thing that has to be, you know, torn down. And so rhetoric's one thing, but you get in office and it's really about making things work, building up the state. And that's what I really have enjoyed hearing about Tuberville, is talking about jobs, manufacturing jobs, talking about education. I mean, the very first interview he gave, he talked about, you know, reading and math, and getting, you know, kids, you know, and so as he goes about this, he'll learn and understand that Alabama has made some strides there. It's just like, let's keep our foot on the gas pedal on that. So I think there's some promising things, but he's got a long time to kind of figure out how he wants to govern. And I think that's a good thing.
And I don't know how your conversation is going to go when it airs, but my conversation with him, I was surprised how caught up he was. I went to his rollout in Auburn at Byron's Smokehouse, and he took questions from him with a press gaggle. And I guess the perception was, all right, here comes a new cowboy, and he's going to throw a monkey wrench and everything. And this is sort of how he went about it in a Senate run, a very broad, you know, help Trump kind of thing. But I guess he wasn't laser focused on particular issues or anything, but he did seem to have somewhat of an awareness, more of an awareness than I thought he would have, on what's going on at the state level.
Absolutely. And he doesn't need to be absolutely precise. That's not the job of a governor. You need to set broad goals, figure out what problems do exist and all that. And he's getting, and you know, running for governor would be different if he was, you know, replacing a Democrat or somebody that he disagreed with. He has publicly praised Kay Ivey and says, you know, he admires her and her work. So it's kind of hard to, like, you know, talk about all the change that needs to be done, but hey, you know, she's doing a great job. So there's a balance there. And again, there's a difference between rhetoric on the campaign trail and actually getting into office, because there's always a difference there. There's always going to be a learning curve. Look, any governor that comes in is going to have to learn. I was talking with Steve Flowers. He's also a guest on Capital Journal tonight. And it's so rare that somebody from Washington comes down, returns to the state to be governor. Last person to do that was Bob Riley, who I worked for a long time ago. And the same thing with him. He had to, you know, get caught up on how state government works as opposed to Congress, and it became a very effective governor. I see the same kind of traits in Tuberville, especially in the fact that he will truly be an outsider in the capital city. I think that can serve him well in terms of keeping his own counsel and not being manipulated, kind of like Bentley was. Bentley came in so naive that it was so easy for folks to manipulate him one way or the other. That's not Tuberville. He is a lot, you know, he keeps his own counsel, and I don't think he would be apt to be manipulated like that. That's a good thing for the state.
Well, and I think there are, you know, some parallels there with Bentley and Tuberville kind of being an outsider, but Bentley was the unexpected governor. Tuberville is the expected governor, and like he's talking about the runway, I think that's important. When Bentley came in, and I remember when he was governor-elect, and he didn't have a lot of allies in that election with Bradley Byrne and Tim James, you know, that thought he could win it. There's a little bit of a chip on his shoulder about that, I thought, at the very, very onset of things, that maybe it maybe imperiled him later on in his administration. Well, Tuberville, like you said, with this long runway, he's going to have at least some time to kind of figure that out and not be in that same, you know, not have that same mentality at least. So I was just like, you know, at what point do we start seeing some of these lawmakers start to rally around him and, you know, get behind some kind of an agenda? But I feel like that's, we are starting from ground zero there.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. And yeah, I mean, that's the Bentley example is what you don't want to do. And you're right. They would not let anybody help them. I mean, I was leaving the Riley administration at the time. We were supposed to meet with our incoming counterparts, and they would refuse to meet with us. I mean, it was insane just because they were bitter about the election. So, yeah, that's the wrong way to do things. And you saw how that ended. I do think Tuberville, again, we're making a lot of assumptions here, but it seems pretty likely. I think he is open to counsel and open to advice and all that, but also skeptical. And, you know, like I said, keeps his own counsel and not just being willing to, you know, be manipulated in that way. I think he's going to be a lot more. Yeah, I think he comes into it with more skepticism, but an openness to those who truly have their best interests at heart. That's the thing. Everybody has their own self-interest, and it's hard to find folks that are going to be loyal to you and just tell you the truth unvarnished without painting it in a way that benefits their interests. That's hard to find. And so he's got a big job in terms of surrounding himself with those exact kind of people.
And we'll wrap it up on this. My perception of Alabama politics, now I've been back into the Alabama game for about 7 years, 8 years now, but it's hard. It's hard to understand Alabama and the way that town works. It's unlike anything else we do in politics. It's so different from Washington, D.C. I mean, some of the trades and practices are similar, but the dynamics are very, very different. And, you know, what are his expectations there? That remains, I mean, I think he kind of gets it, but it's not going to be anything like sort of like a, you know, even a Trump Congress relationship. It's your governor of Alabama, and this legislature in some ways is very deferential to the governor, but I feel like Ivy had to earn that in some capacity, and he'll have to do the same.
Oh yeah. And I think, you know, much will be said and written about Kay Ivey when she leaves office, but I think one thing most folks can agree on is, you know, the whole steadying the ship of state after the Bentley debacle. We had some rough times, and, you know, she has been kind of a stabilizing force. And so, you know, maybe if you call that a bridge, you know, if you will, so Tuberville has the opportunity to take advantage of that. A lot of things have been done to improve the state, move the state forward, fix a lot of the problems of the past. And he can be the beneficiary of that by building on it, right? I mentioned education. Right. That's a prime example. Infrastructure, stuff like that. These issues that some progress has been made, but he can, like, really, you know, put his foot on the gas. So if he's smart, you know, you take advantage of what's already been built for you and take credit for it.
Todd, real quick, folks want to find out Capital Journal, Alabama Daily News. Tell what they need to know.
Absolutely. Capital Journal is tonight at 7:30 on Alabama Public Television. And you can always get the newsletter by going to aldailynews.com and your name and your email, and you'll be on the list.
Todd Stacy, ladies and gentlemen. Todd, thanks.
All right, Jeff, be good.
All right, we'll be right back. This is FM Talk 106.5. Welcome back to the Jeff Poore Show at FM Talk 106.5. Thanks for staying with us on this Friday morning. Text line 251-343-0106. You need to be in touch with the show. That's what you do. Still to come on the program. We went a little long with Todd there, so this will be a quick segment. But still to come on the program next hour, we'll talk to Bradley J. from Breitbart News. There's still a lot going on in D.C., a little bit of a lull right now. They're still kind of ironing out in the Senate what they're going to accept from the big, beautiful bill versus what the House passed. We're just having this big discussion about Medicaid, and somehow or another, Medicaid is the third rail in this state. So I don't know. That and we'll talk about that and more. And then our returning champion, State Senator Chris Elliott. Mike writes, who would have guessed Todd Ivey would praise Meemaw's conservatism while discussing Coach? Well, I tried to, like, it's going to be different. And I don't know how aggressive Tommy Tuberville will be as governor. Second, like, is it going to be a new day in Alabama and everything's going to change, like going from Biden to Trump? Because going from Ivy to Tuberville, going from Ivy to anybody, to be honest, is going to be a stark contrast. And that's going to ruffle some feathers. Whose, I don't know, but it's just utterly predictable. Let's get a break here. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Porter Show on FM Talk 106.5. Mama tried.
Pocket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between. An insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way. No.
Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thanks for being with us on this Friday morning. Not sure what happened there. 251-343-0106. If you want to be in touch with the show, all you got to do is text me. So it'll come on the program here in about a half hour. We'll hear from Bradley J., my colleague at Breitbart News. Also on the program in the 11 o'clock hour, State Senator Chris Elliott. Back to the text. And there's a bunch of them here, and I got caught up on a couple here, and it slowed me down. A named Texter. Hey, Jeff, are you hearing anything on either of the two public service commission seats that are up in 2026, or Odin and Beaker running again? I don't know about Beaker. I hear Odin will have a challenger, the sheriff, Matt Gentry in Coleman County. I think he's filed with the Secretary of State's office. The other one, the Beaker seat, I don't know. Very little discussion about that at this stage of the game. A named Texter, do you think Carolee Dobson would run for agriculture commissioner? I don't think so. She would probably be a pretty good candidate for Secretary of State, but it doesn't sound like she's really interested in that. I think she takes the PSC seat. She's going to be appointed to it next week, is my understanding. And then what we'll see is perhaps either a bid for that election, or a bid for Senate or something of that order. But she's one of the most courted candidates, and it's curious to me. Let's see. A new texter, am I the only one who gets Pat Buchanan mixed up with Pat Robertson? I can see both in my mind's eye. I get them confused on who said or did what. Didn't both run for president? Yeah, and Robertson did real well either Iowa or New Hampshire. And then it didn't really amount to much after that. But Buchanan did really well. I think he won a primary in New Hampshire very early. So, I don't get the two confused ever. Very different sort of public figures. But I guess in the same vein, they are candidates who kind of ran as, you know, insurrection guerrilla type candidates up against a big, massive machine. Let's keep rolling here. I'm going to get these knocked out as promised. After that blank show of the Alabama governorship of the last 20 years, Tuberville will be easily the best governor in history. Not from Damn Yankee. No. Not from another. Let's see. Yeah. I would say this, and the Barmaid of Bar's Low. What is the best governor in the last 20 years, aside from Tuberville? Is it Bob Riley? We've had it's not been a great run. Now, Riley didn't have any scandals, served two full terms. Well, I mean, what was remarkable about the Riley years? The failed tax increase? So, anyway, and then, you know, obviously Bentley, and then finally Governor Ivey. I think people in the state, maybe we need a little more of a proactive governor. It's like the void that is being filled here, but let's look at 2010. You finally have governor, legislature, Republicans, right? And all the energy seemed to be my cover to Del Marsh really leading the charge on this because it was new. It was the first time since Reconstruction that we had had a sort of unified government with Republicans. So there's a real eagerness to get to work. And obviously when it's new and the legislature finally is Republican, that's where you need to really do. That's where the change, the fundamental change has to originate. I'll never understand. Well, I mean, I kind of understand a little bit about Governor Ivey maybe not being that, but she's leaving so much on the table of what she could have done, what she could have been. I think she's got lots of political capital. She could have done some extraordinary things. Very popular. Maybe that's where popularity lies, is that she's, you know, more of a ceremonial governor. And she picks 2-3 things a year that she's going to do, and they seem like small potatoes. This is something like Joey Clark and I had a discussion about in one of our segments. And the excitement over very small issues, some of these cultural issues, they're not insignificant, but they're not really life-changing either. They're not something that's really moving the needle in your everyday life. Not something to get excited about, at least from my perspective. Not widening interstates or building bridges. Kind of maintaining the status quo. I mean, let's even look at the whole approach to infrastructure is very emblematic of an Ivy tenure. And Coach said something I thought really hit me. She's maintained the status quo with roads and bridges by rehabilitating all these sort of back roads and bridges around rural Alabama. Rehabilitating 2059 in Birmingham. Repaving roads, putting asphalt on top of older roads. And that's like some very symbolic of an Ivy tenure. Just making the status quo longer lasting. Extending economic incentives. Picking up the ball where Governor Riley and Governor Bentley left it with workforce development at the junior college level. And there's not like a really anything new. Just going back to the well. And the state, if you really believe Alabama is a place to be, and it is growing, I mean, there's population, there's pockets of population that are growing. But we have a problem. They're already talking about 2030 losing a congressional seat. Maybe that's just a scare tactic to get you to participate in the U.S. Census. I don't know. But we're not, obviously, the population boom isn't quite like it is in some places. We'll spend a lot of time talking about how great Huntsville, Baldwin County, and places like that are. And we're building the port. We're improving the port. It's not like we're building a new port of Mobile. We're improving that. What's new? What's changing from the status quo? The biggest thing I guess she's doing is this West Alabama corridor. But we're like maintaining the same education bureaucracy. We're just putting in measures that allow the arrangement with the teachers union to exist. And when you do something like school choice, it's not big. It's we're gonna kind of ease into it. We're gonna slowly get into it. And so here's what I would say to you guys, and I think this is kind of the time to start thinking about these things. You're going to have a blank slate with Tommy Tuberville. And you got to start thinking about what you want him to do different. It'll be responsive. If you want a responsive governor to what you think the state needs or what you'd like to see, and it has to be like something really big that changes, not just like, and I don't know what that is at this point, a departure from the status quo. Then what is it? I mean, even widening I-65 is sort of the status quo. Just more capacity. More school choice. Less of a focus on higher ed seems to be something Coach was talking about. And, you know, we live in a state now, I always talk about the big mules, was a term of the 20th century. The industrialists, the planters and the big mule coalition, or I think I got it backwards, big mule and planter coalition, whatever. But they're the people who run the state. Well, our big mules now, it's not, I mean, it's always been the power company. But now it's like the University of Alabama system and Auburn to some degree. The Poarch Creek Indians. Gambling. You know, gambling's not even legal in Alabama, and yet they have a lot of clout in the state house. And maybe that's where Tommy Tuberville could be a little different. I mean, really, is it a lottery? Is a lottery really going to change your life that much? And you can only do so much, but can it be profound like a Ron DeSantis or Greg Abbott? Because the 50 laboratories of democracy, right? That Alabama needs to lead the way. And Alabama has to really show bold and big leadership here. And the rest of the country follows suit. We haven't really been there. Most notably during COVID. We're really slow to depart with some of the COVID protocol in Alabama versus Georgia, Tennessee, Mississippi, and Florida. Income tax, our taxation. It's a throwback to the last century. Low property taxes. High state or high sales and kind of a mid-tier income tax. So this is the chance. This is the opening. You may not get it for a little while. 251-343-0106. We'll be right back. This is FM Talk 106.5. Welcome back to the Jeff Porch Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thanks for staying with us on this Friday morning. 251-343-0106. If you need to be in touch with the show, that's what you do. You text me, and we'll respond accordingly. Dan Yankee writes, big changes, you say. Number one, year-round school, grades K through 12. More college courses in high schools. Industry-sponsored internships for high school students and young adults, need I go on? Yeah, I mean, think bigger than that. Like, every day, you get up, damn Yankee, you get up and go to work. You take your kids to school, maybe. I don't know if you have kids or not. You go to the store. You buy stuff. I know. What's really going to change your life on a daily basis? Not that government needs to be that impactful in your life. But we complain about things in Alabama. Well, then how do you fix them? Or what makes it better? What makes it more unique? Place people want to come. What could Ivy have done different? Because the things the legislature has done, I'm not saying they're bad things. A lot of them are good. They're very small, marginal things. I guess the small things, the marginal things are very hard to get done. It's hard to reform the occupational licensing boards. It's hard to get a new Department of Archives and History board. It's hard to get these things done. It should be easy in a Republican supermajority. You shouldn't be beholden to two Democrats. It's hard to change people in Birmingham who are underserved by the Birmingham Water Works. It took years to get that done. And that should have been done like years ago. These hotbeds for corruption. I mean, dare I say gambling. People want gambling in the state. I'm not convinced that they do. Why should we be beholden to the existing gambling interest in Alabama? Why are these things so hard to do? And get, well, you know what that's sort of the point I'm trying to make. And a lot of things that get done aren't on anybody's radar. Who's clamoring for more AltaPoint contracts? Who's clamoring for big changes at the Veterans Board? Who's asking for that? Who's like, you know what? We need to spend a week on changing the Veterans Affairs Department in this state. It took years to get school choice. These like kind of no-brainer things take way too long. It's a slow roll, slow walk. To get like sort of no-brainer Republican bread and butter policy done. Now, they were very fast when they took over in 2010. Riley calls a special session. They moved. No, nah, it's just kind of like, well, we couldn't get it done today. We'll come back and try again tomorrow or next week or whatever. And we can find out, like, can you be sort of a Ron DeSantis administration? Think bigger, you say, about black and black crime. How about teenager gangs? How about police corruption? But look how hard it is to even get that immunity bill done for police. Things move slow. And I think it needs to move a little, not necessarily to be very efficient, but it needs to move faster. We'll be right back. This is FM Talk 106.5. Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thanks for staying with us on this Friday morning. Text line 251-343-0106. If you want to be in touch with the program, hit us up on the text line. Coming up in about an hour from now, we'll hear from our returning champion, State Senator Chris Elliott, as we typically do on Fridays. Joining us now on the line, I believe we have him. He's my colleague at Breitbart News. Bradley Jay is with us. Bradley, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Doing great, Jeff. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for making time for us. Always appreciate that. Well, you know, it's things are a little subdued right now, I think, on in congressional politics. But what do we know? Big, beautiful bill. The Senate's going to take its bite at the apple. And I'd say this, my perception of like kind of watching this, that they seem like they're playing their cards really close to the vest here and not talking a lot about it necessarily publicly.
You're right, Jeff. We're just a little over 40 days out from the 4th of July deadline that Senator Thune set for the Senate passing it. I'll note that Breitbart News broke the news of that deadline. But it's recess this week. Senators are back at home. They really, it seems like, don't want to get too far out in front on this fight. We still don't even know if how involved the committees will be, if this is something where they're going to really go all out and use all the procedural tools they have to draw this out. We just really don't know. It'll be interesting to see how Thune does decide to move forward. He's kept pretty tight-lipped, but when things come back next week, it's going to be boom, 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 and I expect they'll start moving very quickly because they have a lot to hash out, and the Republican conference in the Senate is much different than the one in the House. So I imagine that the final product we get out there will be far different than the one we got.
Yeah, and the only people you see, and I watch a lot of cable news, if you can't tell, but Ron Johnson, Rand Paul from the Senate, even like in their appearances, like a Ted Cruz, not as, you know, or Katie Britt or Tuberville a little bit, but he's kind of running for governor. So, but you know, you're not seeing the Thunes or the Cornyns or guys like that really stake a position out one way or another.
It's interesting because Trump has given the Senate free rein. He's said publicly, look, they're going to want to make some changes. Go ahead, do what you need to do. I expect a lot of this, though, is moving behind the scenes with the White House leading the charge. There's no doubt that the White House is the one that got this across the finish line in the House. I mean, there's no question there. They were leading those negotiations. But yet, the Senate doesn't want to put together a package that can't pass in the House. Certainly, the White House doesn't want that, and the House doesn't want that either. So there is, even in the Senate, even with some of these members who we ordinarily wouldn't think are really with us as conservatives in the Republican conference up there, there's a sense that we've got to get this done. Nobody wants the largest tax increase in American history, even if you're Susan Collins or Lisa Murkowski or his name's a dirty word for me, but Mitch McConnell. They don't want that bad juju. So they're actually, for once, seems like folks are operating in good faith to try to get a deal done. And I don't think that they will do anything, most of them, who will move the package so far that it can't get back to the House and pass and get to the president's desk.
How much sway does Trump have with the Senate? And I think you and I talked about this maybe last time, way more with the House and showing up on Capitol Hill and doing an appearance there. The Senate, not quite as much, just because of the traditions and standards and norms.
You're right, and Trump has very shrewdly altered his approach from his first term in how he deals with the Senate. Look, there's hardly, maybe Thomas Massey is the only one in the House that he can't really strong arm when the rubber hits the road. It's not that way in the Senate. You've even got some Republicans up there who might even like to burnish their credentials by bucking Trump every now and then. But it's 53 seats in the Senate. To pass reconciliation, you need 50 plus J.D. Vance. So he has a little bit of room to operate, but he's also being very respectful of them, their authority, and importantly, their egos as he tries to navigate this. So Trump's doing everything that he needs to do. They've got a little bit of time to get this done. If time goes by, they hadn't moved as quickly as Trump wants, will he change his tack? We'll have to see. But things are definitely going to be speeding along starting next week when everybody gets back into town.
Let's talk about this, and I spent a little time on it this morning, and I think you and I, you know, there was a conversation about it this morning on a call we were on. Sort of the Federalist Society, the Trump True Social post, and I got to thinking about this, Bradley. Trump's going to there's going to be Supreme Court vacancies, I would think, even before the 2026 midterms. How much of this might be like a ploy to distance himself from being beholden to the Federalist Society? If you got maybe potentially two Supreme Court seats you're going to have to fill in the coming months or year. And that, I think there's something to this. I mean, I we've been let down by these guys, and it's different now. I think when Trump was in office in 17 to 21, it was more of a Mitch McConnell controlled process. Maybe it's much different this time. Maybe now that he can take a look at his own people and put them on the Supreme Court.
I think you're right. This is not the same Trump that we had in 2016 where, poof, on a whim, he might fire off a tweet that could disrupt the whole news cycle. He can still do that and will from time to time, but I don't think that it's as he's a little more farsighted down the field looking than he was. I don't think there's any question that Trump is doing what he can to shift things around, shift the playing field around. The Federalist Society has always kind of been the only game in town for conservatives, Republicans, when it came to elevating lawyers and judges. Trump definitely seems to be sending signals when his post, was it early this morning or late last night, I believe. You know what? We might need some other people to take the reins here. And the way that the conservative ecosystem has evolved just since Trump's first term, I think that there are a lot of other people who could step up and fill that void. You don't have to spend decades building an organization like you used to, like Leonard Leo did, and building the Federalist Society. I think Trump definitely, if there is an opening, and even just, you know, below the Supreme Court, some other judicial openings, Trump is gonna seek his own counsel a little bit more, but also folks that he trusts a little bit more and aren't necessarily just, the go-tos for Republicans, because there have been so many changes other voices that have emerged a lot more quickly than they would have in the past. It would be very interesting to see if just in the next few months, if there was an opening on the court, what direction Trump would go in. I don't think that you would see the Amy Coney Barrett type. And to your point, Trump has more, not control, but influence over the Senate, just because, well, Thune doesn't have the advantage of over a decade with an iron grip over the conference like McConnell had. So there are folks who aren't just beholden to what McConnell tells them, and Thune's doing a fine job, but it could take a decade for him to have the kind of pull that McConnell has, and even then, I don't know. So that would be very interesting to see. It would definitely be a change in approach than just 8 years ago.
Yeah, and let's talk about it. I mean, you know, 8 years ago, Trump comes in and tries to, like, put a bunch of people in who are, you know, like, you look at his cabinet, everything seemed like it was trying to be an olive branch. I mean, he put Mitch McConnell's wife as Secretary of Transportation. He's not doing that now. So there's no reason to think he's going to do that again, you know, following that suit with his judicial appointments. I think just based on that alone, there's no need to go kiss the ring of the D.C. establishment, because they're just not going – they're not going to cooperate. You can do everything and try to bring everybody together, but the lesson learned there was, well, even if I do that, it's still like everything is horse trading, so the hell with this. I'm just going to do things my way.
Well, now the D.C. establishment is kissing his ring. It's the other way around. There's no doubt in the first administration that well, even as Trump was securing the nomination in 2016, Trump and the RNC, the Republican Party establishment, that was a very uncomfortable marriage. And you saw that just, I mean, in the opening hours of his first term, you started having scalps and folks getting picked off, and it was just constant chaos. Now, I mean, Trump's the paterfamilias. He's in charge. He's running things. And if you're not on the team, well, what team are you on? You can get in line with Bill Kristol if you want, who's just kind of floating in no man's land. But Trump's running things, and I don't think if there were an opening on the Supreme Court, we would see Trump flex his muscles, perhaps unlike in, or even more so than any other decision that he's made so far.
Yeah, I think that's such a good point. And, you know, that it's not just necessarily D.C. establishment, but it looks like maybe even now more so of a just a conservative movement in general. Like, there was still a lot of skepticism. Now, when he won the nomination in 16, everybody sort of unified behind him. But then over the – even out of office – He was kind of coalescing that what you want to call it, grassroots, or even the think tank crowd, the heritage types, you know, all these other offshoots. And now it's no longer the idealism of like Reagan conservatism that used to really kind of run that side of the Republican Party. Seems like it's now embraced like a Trump style. But, I was talking about Pat Buchanan, who was really kind of the godfather of this, but it's embraced that type, that brand.
In 2016, folks were unsure that the Trump coalition would hold. In 2021, folks were unsure that the Trump coalition would hold. It was really the resiliency that Trump showed in this campaign, as he locked up the nomination, despite the lawfare and so many of the folks reverting back to form and abandoning him after January 6th. Trump showed that, look, this coalition, if we will continue to honor them, it will hold. If we put America first, then dadgummit, Americans are going to support us. He's proved that. And the resiliency of Trump and Trumpism is what has led to Trump having such control right now. I tweeted out last night a bunch of videos, video clips from the Heritage Foundation president just praising Trump and talking. He talked a lot about that coalition, the Trump-Vance coalition, and what it might look for in the future. That's a pretty strong indication that Trump is in charge, because, as you know, the Heritage Foundation is one of those more normie-type groups that was resistant to Trump at first. So it's a new ball game. Democrats are in disarray. If we hold true to the principles that have us in this position, we could be looking at being in charge for a long time. But if we abandon them, we'll lose the House. Who knows what could happen in the next election. So it's still, we can still drop the ball. I think we need to lean in and not get not get cold feet right now, though.
Well, and you know, this is not really talked about a whole lot, but that conservative ink, right, crowd, the you know, that was really built on a Cold War 1980s approach to conservatism, it kind of lost out. It's not, you know, it looked like it could make a comeback during the whole Tea Party wave, but the Tea Party wave was just populism that really, I felt like, didn't know what it wanted. Constitution, which is still important, but it's this protectionism or the tariffs, right? I mean, that, you know, the whole concept of free trade, it doesn't work in this century, because the economy is such a global economy. You know, things like that, where Republicans are now the party of the protectionism that used to be in the last part of the last century, used to be more of a Democrat hallmark.
Go back and listen to Mitch McConnell's retirement announcement speech on the Senate floor. February of last year? It's amazing how time flies. He was talking about how he came of age during the Reagan years, and that was where he formed all of his political views. Well, the world is a completely different world. And it was like hearing someone describe a time and an era that just didn't exist. And it was very revealing on the how these old school type polls like McConnell view the world. It's not through the eyes of you and me, and it's not through the eyes of the American people who live in the real world, not in their academic ivory towers like McConnell, but actually have to deal with day-to-day issues with the economy and changing a price and housing availability and things like that. Mitch McConnell doesn't have to worry about that. His wife and her family are making plenty of money off the Chinese Communist Party, and he sees no problem in pushing back on the fentanyl trade or illegal immigration. He does just enough to survive politically. But there are so many people who still live in that world, and they don't see politics as this. You know, how can I vote? Politicians can I support who will actually advance the interest of my family and my legacy and my survival? I mean, we've got people who just live in banana land, a world of long ago, but the coalition that Trump has put together doesn't look like that. And so I think it's got a lot of staying power if we can stay true to it. There's no doubt that after Trump leaves, the establishment will strike back. I hope we have someone after him who can actually carry the flag.
Bradley, we're a little long here. We got to get out of here. But folks want to find you online. How can they do so?
I'm on Twitter or X at Bradley AJ and Breitbart.com. Got a good exclusive coming this afternoon from an interview with Secretary Doug Collins at the VA. So look out for that.
Bradley, we'll talk again soon. Thanks for hopping on this morning.
Can't wait to talk again, brother.
All right, guys, we got to get a break in here. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Poore Show at FM Talk 106.5.
And now I do. And don't it make my brown eyes.
Welcome back to the Jeff Flores Show on FM Talk 106.5. That's the norm with my guests lately. I went way, way, way long in that last segment, but we'll make it up to you on the other side, get some of your text. 251-343-0106 if you want to get in on that. Still come on to program State Senator Chris Elliott. That's at the bottom of the next. I'll get his reaction to sort of how things are starting to settle in a little for this 2026 election cycle. It's here we are, the end of May, and the silly season has begun. But all the dominoes are starting to fall into place. People kind of know what they're up against now, or what they would be up against if they were to seek a certain office. I guys, I'll tell you about the Senate race. I know how people are thinking, hey, I could be U.S. Senator. And I just don't, you know, that's a big, to go from like a failed Jefferson County Sheriff candidate to U.S. Senate, that's tough. I don't think it's something that someone who is not in elected office right now is up for. Now, I could be wrong. I mean, look at Mike Durant, had some success. It is Alabama, and even Roy Moore had a tenure on the bench. Doug Jones, U.S. attorney, I guess. I don't know. But just to come out of nowhere, say, hey, I want to be U.S. senator. That's a lot. We'll be right back. This is FM Talk 106.5.
Pocket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between. An insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way.
No. Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thank you for being with us on this Friday morning. 251-343-0106. Text me. Let me know what's on your mind. Chris Elliott, my state senator, I should say, not ours. There's a varying state senators depending on where you live. But he'll be with us. He's our show's returning champion. That's at the bottom of the hour. I'm going to knock out these texts here that have accumulated over the last half hour. Unnamed texter writes me an essay here. Do I want to read all this? I'll give it a shot here. Jeff coaches all about America first. He will be fan-freaking-tabulous upgrade of what we've had in the state for a long time. When I was in D.C. last week, I told him and his staff I was excited to see the many things the administration is doing, including, not limited to, DOGE, elimination of state income taxes, focus on children's education, dangers of drugs, getting medical or medicinal marijuana in the license, putting the power back in the hands of parents, school choice, let's see, putting the fear of God into these legislators and reminding them that they work for the constituents, not the pharmaceutical industry or big box retailers, or for that matter, PCI. Pass a clean lottery bill. Coach says what he means, and he makes no bones about it, which is exactly what I want. We want to pump the brakes on this a little bit. He's not going to be able to bully the legislature around. I just have to tell you that right now. I can't see that being in the cards. They have a mind of their own, right? They got elected independent of Tommy Tuberville. It would be interesting to see if any lawmakers or potential candidates for the Alabama legislature would run on a Tuberville ticket in the way that a lot of people in the state run on a Trump ticket. That would be interesting to me if a candidate for the state house says, hey, I'm going to go to Montgomery and I'm going to help promote the Tuberville agenda. Are we there yet? I guess we got to know what the Tuberville agenda is first and see how it polls. But would that be a campaign tactic? Gene writes, Alliance Defending Freedom is a new, dumber version of the Heritage Foundation. And then Alliance Defending Freedom is a little different. It's more of a political, it's way more political than policy. Like Gene, the Heritage Foundation, I've spent a lot of time at that building over the years. It's really, there's a lot going on there. It's like a TV studio and a radio studio upstairs. They convene these meetings, these gatherings of like DC conservatives. And they put out a lot of policy papers. They take these guys who, in a normal, reasonable world, would be teaching in higher ed, higher academia, but can't get their foot in the door there because academia is so left wing. And they spend time on these, like, dissecting these issues, running models about tax policy, national defense, trade, trying to kind of map it out on a, you know, in a hypothetical way, modeling. I mean, you think that the stuff that they do, maybe it is certainly theoretical, but they try to test it the best they can, offer theories and troubleshoot the unintended consequences. And then they present it to lawmakers on Capitol Hill and their staff. And there's a lot of these kind of places like that, Gene. And then the left does it too. Brookings Institute, Center for American Progress. You got AEI. You got Cato. It used to be the libertarian think tank, but now it's more of a sort of a corporate libertarianism, I guess. Koch Brothers-y. And sometimes they, like, meet up and they, you know, they talk about IT. Only in a place like Washington, D.C. where these things thrive. Well, I find, like, the Alliance Defending Freedom is more of an activist organization. That they already have a set of assumptions that they operate on. I mean, I know you probably think, well, you're all conservative, it's all the same, who cares? But it's not. It varies. I mean, you have the same sort of phenomenon on the left. It's what DC is. These are like the philosopher kings of the federal government landscape. Mommy issues, problems America, Americans aren't being put first, with the midterms being a reckoning for conservatives. Cut Medicaid, lied about cutting Social Security, and the taco president. Well, everyone's afraid to talk about Medicaid. We have a Medicaid problem in America. I mean, I really believe this. Medicaid is enabling a lot of able-bodied adults not to get into the workforce. It is causing a lot of strife on the balance sheet. Look, people want more of their own money back, and whether it's the billionaires or you and I. We have a progressive tax structure in this country. The more you make, the higher percentage you pay. The less you make, you pay a lower percentage. Or some cases, you get more from the federal government than you ever put in your lifetime. FDR decided after the Great Depression or during the Great Depression, we would have a social safety net. We wouldn't be in this situation anymore. Social safety net, you want to do it for the right reasons, the ethical reasons, but it's also, it's important you don't have hungry people, sick people, things that destabilize the country and allow radical political movements to take hold like they did in Europe. That's what Germany, you look at Germany after World War One. And the world is very punitive. Rightly so. But you force these people into a situation of poverty. And what comes out of that? A radical ideology, a radical political movement. And the rise of Nazism. Same with Italy. I mean, we just assume FDR was, hanging out in D.C. Hey, wouldn't it be great if we had Social Security? But there's a little more to it than that. It's the same with the farm subsidies. And all of these things that have been done over the last 100 years in America have had unintended consequences around the globe. And some of those unintended consequences we're still living with today. Probably one of the biggest ones was when FDR freezed wages and prices. And what happened was they just figured out a way around it. Started offering health insurance. Started offering retirement as a way to kind of get around those wage controls. And it gave birth to what we have today, this Frankensteinian healthcare system. And now we're talking about Medicaid as if the government has an obligation to provide health care. Or Social Security, even. There you say that. You can't say that, though, because people freak out. Well, I paid into it all my life, and they did. But how much are they getting out of it? How much is the government, borrowing off of it? Mike writes, out of all the state politicians, I really think Senator Elliott will be the most excited about Coach as governor. Elliott is one of the few truly conservative lawmakers up on Goat Hill. I see Dan Roberts in the Senate, Shea Shelnut. There's some names. Certainly in the House, there's the Braveheart Caucus, as I like to call them. Arnold Mooney, Ben Harrison, and Ernie Yarborough. I'm hoping that grows. You need guys who work within the system. You don't need a bunch of Ron Paul types. There's just not enough numbers there. And Elliott kind of works within the system the best he can. The Senate, it's a lot harder. You truly have obstructionist Democrats. And you talk about, Montgomery's not really that partisan of a place, but it is in some cases. Jerry, if that blue-haired, brain-dead governor is able to bully the legislature, I believe Coach will be able to do it. Ivy has the backing of a lot of the business community and the political operatives and, the people who are heavily invested in state government that enables her. Why wasn't Bentley able to? How is Ivy getting away with sort of what she does and Bentley not, you know, and he cut some corners there. He gave some openings to, I think, an establishment that wanted him out of the way. He got on the bad side of some conservatives. They started beating the drum of impeachment. They would later have their own shortcomings. But that's what happened. And I'm not saying that Tommy Tuberville needs to be looking over his shoulder always. Kind of like, I need to be worried about this and this and this and this happening to me. But he needs to be aware of it. I'm sure he is, or he will be. Should he be, and probably will be, elected governor of Alabama. We'll be right back. This is FM Talk 106.5. In the redneck Riviera, getting crazy. I'm getting hammered, sitting right here at the Florida Bama. At the Florida Bama.
I fly a starship across the universe divide. And when I reach the other side, I'll find a place to rest my spirit if I can. Perhaps I may become a highwayman again.
Welcome back to the Jeff Moore Show on FM Talk 106.5, 24 minutes after the hour. Programming note, coming up on Monday's show, Jennifer Fiddler. We haven't heard from her. Well, it's been 3 weeks. She'll be with us. Ag Commissioner, running for Lieutenant Governor Rick Pate, and WVNN's Dale Jackson, I believe, assuming they've had some problems up at his station. He's been off the air for some days now, and their transmitter's been down. I'm on the show on Wednesdays, and they're having to pre-tape it. He's having to pre-tape his show, and I don't know how they're getting it out over the air. But hopefully he's back to normal. Nate Texeras is lining up the two most interesting races to watch are going to be Lieutenant Governor and Attorney General. I think Senate, U.S. Senate will get some national attention. And Todd and I were talking about this, guys. They look at the Alabama U.S. Senate landscape as, hey, anybody can do it. Anybody can run in Alabama. Hey, there's a Senate seat up for grabs. We will find an Alabamian, and we will get behind them and financially back them. And all it takes is just a little momentum, and it's just not the case, I don't believe. John. If people have higher incomes, then they should be able to pay a higher income tax rate, and that's the way it should be. If conservatives disagree with that, they count me out. How is that fair? If you pay 20, 30, 40% of your income, and then somebody else isn't paying 20, 30, 40% of their income, I mean, John, you're a liberal. I'm sorry. If you think the rich need to pay more taxes, it's a Robin Hood approach. That's not conservatism. That's class warfare. Was it, Sean Hannity says, I never got a job from a poor person. Well, we do have a progressive tax structure in America, but a fidelity to that is not conservative. It's just the way it is. So you're making $20,000 a year, and you pay a percentage of that. If you're making $200,000 a year, you pay a higher percentage of that. You make $2 million a year, you pay an even higher percentage of that. And if you only make $2,000 a year, well, they pay you. And it's stair step based on your income, what percentage you pay. That's the way the left views your fair share. And that's a system we have. That's not a conservative. That's not a flat tax or a fair tax or anything like that. Our system just isn't built for those kinds of taxations. I'll tell you what our system in Alabama is built for. Low property taxes, kind of middle-of-the-road income tax, but very high sales tax. Is everybody pays into the system. I saw it to one city official who said, you know, every time the state gives a tax break, it puts more pressure on us to cut our taxes. We're not really, really cool with that. We got a good thing going. People seem appreciative of our city services. And the state's putting pressure on us to cut our taxes. Unnamed texter, how about Chief Justice Sarah Stewart for Senate? I don't think she'd give up a seat on the bench for a long shot U.S. Senate run, especially Chief Justice. 251-343-0106. We'll be right back. This is FM Talk 106.5.
I keep on rolling with the flow. Folks said that I